What's up, everybody? It's Keith from the Stream Team, and with me, as always, Chris Lowry and Cole Miller. And today, 26 minutes to door knock. Mission Impossible. We are still staying on the Mission Impossible train. We are now at
25 minutes to door knock.
25 minutes. Thank you for the update. Ghost Protocol. We're in 2011, so we've gone to Rogue Nation, and now we're back. We went to 3, and now we're at 4. Obviously, we're going up to Fallout before we get Dead Reckoning, so we are getting close to being complete with this. We like to thank Paramount for actually having these. After we went out of order, it kind of screwed things up, made us look like like a couple of jackasses, but it's okay, though.
Just real quick, that 2011 hurt. Like, right. I know it's weird, every right? time you think about it, you're like, no, I don't believe that. I don't want to believe it.
2011, buddy.
Yes, sir.
Anybody's?
I remember this one.
Anybody good at math? That's 12 years. Long time.
Yeah.
More than some of the other ones. Like, I can acknowledge that the other ones are older. Maybe because this one, like, is when they take that turn in, you know, like, not even quality, but just the series has that shift, and it certainly starts with this, and they start to look a little different. So maybe it's like, you know, obviously they've kind of updated a little bit as time has gone on, but they've maintained this look for all of them. So when I think about this one being in 2011, I was like, this movie looks like it came out in 2015 at the absolute worst. But that's if you look at it compared to all the other ones after that. So it is, I'm sure we'll talk about that too, but it's like, it's the same series, but man, it's so weird, like that like shift that happens in this one. And I know it's like a continued storyline, but just so like almost the aesthetic, like this, the change that happens here that kind of carries throughout of it. It's so, and it's crazy because it works, like we were talking about last week. They just do shit in these movies, and they just continue to work. Like, they had that one time when it didn't work, and they're like, sorry about that.
And it still kind of worked.
Still made.
It didn't, but it still did. Yeah,
knocked on the
yeah.
door of a billion. I say knocked on the door, but.
You're right. Like, there is something about this that is brighter. And it's not necessarily just, like, the picture contrast, like, just in general. Like, the mood is brighter. The acting is brighter. They find stars that are, you know, I wouldn't say for the most part, like Tom Cruise obviously is a megastar, but a lot of the other people in this one specifically were up and comers, right? And I know Jeremy Renner was obviously a great addition to the story, and he was here, he was on the scene, he wasn't definitely an up and comer, but it was in his earlier days as far as like this becoming this guy who had quite a career up until the point, and then it was just like, oh, why wasn't this guy a star to begin with? And basically this movie kind of cements why that is the case, right? Even though I'm not 100% sure, but I think The Town was right around this same time. He had obviously done Hurt Locker right around the same time. All those sort of those movies that, you know, cemented him as a great actor. But this is where you start seeing him as like a movie star.
Yeah, he really buds in this, and that's why I really like movies like The Hurt Locker, because at that time, he and Anthony Mackie, of course, they're huge in the Marvel universe now, but at that time they weren't really anybody. I mean,
they were just guys, man.
The biggest person, right? The biggest person in the movie was Guy Pearce, and he didn't even make it through the first 10 minutes of the movie. So we have a case where we have these two relatively unknown guys. I mean, up until that point, you know, Jeremy Renner was kind of a I don't want to say a nobody, but a nobody. And then Anthony Mackie was like Papa Doc, you know, so nobody really knew who these two guys were. And that movie crushed. So it was cool to see that both of them carry a movie like that and do so well. But again, just the small decisions, and I've talked about it ad nauseum with this particular series as we've gone through these movies, the small decisions in this particular franchise to make this movie better. And this, I've talked about it again several times, this is my favorite of the bunch, and all of them are great. I love, you know, Fallout is incredible, but this is my favorite one. And, it, you know, there's a litany of decisions that were made in this movie that made me really enjoy it. The insertion of Renner is at the top of that list for me. He's a guy that Nicole and I have talked about Renner ever since, for us, has ever been ever since The Town. And of course, in particular, the scene where he walks into Ben Affleck's place, and he's, you know, Ben Affleck walks into his place and he's like, you know, I need you to go with me. We're going to hurt some people. You're not going to ask any questions. And he's like, your car or mine?
It's whose car we got?
Yeah. So after that, then we're just like, you know, we're all in on Renner. But having him come into this and be the role that he played, because just like IMF, I mean, we have a guy playing a he's a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude in this, right? Like he's a chief analyst, of course, and he's bright in that aspect, but he's also as they're in the hotel and things go sideways with Moreau and she discovers that they are, you know, that he has the contact lens, and then he rips a gun off and he's beating people up and flipping people over chairs too, and now all of a sudden Ethan's like, okay, a chief analyst that can do that, like, who are you really? So we have,
anytime somebody pulls the chamber out of a gun mid fight so that you can't shoot said gun, mm-hmm. you're not an analyst.
No.
You know, that's just not how it works.
But he was still good at analyzing because Ethan drew a stick figure on his hand, and he's like, "Oh, that's Kurt Kendricks."
That shit is so funny. He's sure like, did. Rough draft,
oh,
but
those,
from the
those scenes always trip me out. He's like, "Who's this
I
guy?"
Love that shit.
Anyway, pulls up a fucking ring camera on his laptop and shows him, and is like, "Who is this guy?" He's like, "Oh, that's blah 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 blah." It's like, "All right, cool.
I can't get enough of it. I can't get enough of it, dude." If he
it's bullshit,
oh, shit, that's
yeah, I love
so
it.
Funny.
I love that shit, man. Whenever he's like, "Who's this guy?" He's like, 60-year-old, you know, 5'10", 160 pounds. Eastern, you know, European accent. He's like, well, it's a rough drawing, but if I had to guess, he's like, yeah. Kirk Hendricks graduated
exactly this
Stockholm
guy.
University, yeah. Graduated top of his class, 190 IQ, and he's also, I was like, gee, I eat that shit up, man. I absolutely.
You don't hear him ask about him or something? What the hell?
Right, like yeah. He knew his whole background, dude. And
it's like, I think it might be, and then gave 50 points about his entire life. Yeah.
Or
it's like Gemini, born on April 14th.
Right. Yeah. A list of his fears and all, yeah, I'm telling you, man. He's
Birthstones and sapphires. Like, what the fuck? How do you know that one specifically?
He's a big Man U fan, and I'm like, man, give me please more of it, dude. I don't care. I want it all. But yeah, Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol 2011. So we have our boy Brad Bird as the director of this, his first live action film. This was
what?
Brad Bird
yes.
films, man.
Yeah, first live action directorial debut.
What a
that.
Thing to pull for your first one. Holy shit.
Right? I'm telling you. And that's
and
what
he crushed
I'm saying. That just seemed to be the case with this whole franchise.
I mean, everything he made was gold, you know?
Right.
Like, why not give him a
try? I know, but holy God, man.
Apparently it was J.J. Abrams, like, wanted him specifically to do it, and it's like, okay, well, all
right. Right.
Yeah, if you get J.J. Abrams' approval, then give him a shot.
Yeah,
you must know a thing or two.
Yeah, this J.J. Abrams guy may be onto something. Let's let him cook. We have a runtime of 2 hours and 12 minutes with this, and it goes quickly for a 2-hour and 12-minute movie. I would say I don't know that it bogged down because all the scenes fed into each other, and we get as the movie slowed down, it sped up with more details. Like when it slowed down, and we heard about. We got the Brandt backstory as far as why he was not in the field anymore, and then we hear about what he was actually doing as far as protecting Ethan and his wife and all that, but then we get what was actually going on too. So I feel like that it moved really quickly. Rotten Tomatoes score 93-76. The audience wasn't crazy about it. 76
really?
Is still a great score, but yeah, from the audience side, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, real weird.
I thought it would at least be in the 80s. I thought like mid-80s.
Movies that are unwatchable that get
85. Yeah.
Yeah, like, truly.
That audience score is nuts. I guess like whenever
fuck,
we see him.
I feel like Black Adam might have been higher than that.
Oh, God.
Seriously.
Actually, I think so. Cause
that's
I know
the
he was
worst
like,
piece of shit I've ever seen.
It might be. I know like when it was tanking, that's what he was promoting. He was like, the movie is this and that, but our Rotten Tomatoes audience score is a... And I was like, oh, my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, 88.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Yeah,
like 38
to 88.
Horseshit.
Jesus Christ.
38 actually.
Oh my God.
38 is like
38
way
to
too
88.
High.
That is
way too high. Is crazy.
38 people out of 100 were like, "Yeah, this slaps."
Critics,
no, sir.
38% of critics, not just people. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. 8.8 people.
Yeah, that's
completely
bullshit.
Wild.
Yeah.
I guess we only think about the
DC, don't sue me, I'm just kidding.
The critic score, we think about these, we always see the graph of like the critic score. So yeah. Like and like you said, 76 isn't bad. Like obviously you know this is a good one, we enjoy
it. I feel
but...
like it might be bad. I feel like that's bad.
Oh, like on the people's end
76?
I mean bad in the sense like 76 doesn't mean it's a bad movie, but like bad in the sense that like
sure.
I can't
yeah,
believe
yeah.
yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, yeah. And bad in the sense of
that
like,
makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
I got you.
No, it's
yeah.
terrible that it's
feel,
a 76.
Like
it should be
of
higher.
Most of the movies we've done, the audience
oh, yeah.
score has been higher than that.
Yeah. Like this is maybe one of the weirdest audience scores we've seen because again, This movie fucking bangs,
given,
man.
Given
this
the success weird. Of the
what
movie.
What did they not like about
right.
it?
I don't know. I kind of want to look into that now. I'm going to try to find some bad reviews and see if people didn't like it. Every now and then we'll do one.
Yeah, 34%. What were they
man,
thinking?
I truly don't know because this movie made almost gosh. $700 million. It made... It's 145
million.
Yeah,
all
the
money.
It's 694.
Guy who sees Ghost Protocol twice.
That was Keith.
I did my part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Keith was running down that mountain.
I got a Mission Impossible pin. They're like,
thank you for your service.
Appreciate it. But it didn't even explode. Yeah.
Thanks,
it wasn't
Keith.
Even a fine tip. It was just a bit. It just had Mission Impossible on there. But Mission had one S in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It couldn't write.
Yeah. Worst pin.
It was a laser light.
It was a straw. I took the lid off of there. It just turned into a straw. I could just drink through it, and that was it. It was just the tube. It is, man. I mean, it's
hey,
useful.
Man, that's progressive when you think about it.
Given the period we're
straw.
In now, man, it was way ahead of the curve.
It's ahead of the
People
curve.
Using paper straws. Just like this movie is so good. We have a cast that's great. We have – so, again, it's just a small wrinkle. We've got, you know, smaller details in this. Again, you know, we have common factors. We have Ethan, of course. We have the IMF involved, of course. But now we have Ghost Protocol, which is being invoked. Ghost Protocol, Chris, was said twice in a 10-minute window. It was said at the 40-minute mark, the 40-minute mark, and the 49-minute mark. Yeah, he said it on the train. Yeah.
True, whereas.
Yeah.
And then they let Tom Cruise
They're having
it,
fun
too.
With it.
Yeah.
That's like one of the few ones you can, like, actually say the title yeah. of it. And you're like, it's not too corny. Like, you can't really say, like... Rogue Nation and not like look in the camera when you say it. Can't be like we're experiencing a bit of fallout.
Yeah.
like you know, you can't give they better not fucking say dead reckoning.
Oh,
there's
happen,
no way you can say dead reckoning. Dead reckoning and be dead.
Oh, it's getting sad.
you
oh,
have to look in the camera.
It's getting sad. I may faint.
Experiencing part one
I
of a little
can't
bit
wait.
Of a little dead reckoning.
It's gonna be the and I hope it's early in the
Hyper
movie
zoom.
Too.
Yeah, if they work part one into it, I'm done. I'm out. I'll never watch another.
I can't wait.
That's crossing the line. When you start adding the parts in there, you're doing too
Cole,
much.
Cole, was you crying when he said Dead Reckoning part one?
Yes, I would be. I would be crying.
But we have Ethan, the movie starts out, Ethan's in prison. He's in a European dungeon prison situation, and the team is breaking him out. We've got Benji, and we've got a new agent
sure
in the field.
Yeah.
We've got Jane, who we don't know yet, but we're, you know, she's out in the field. We're breaking him out, so we got to figure out why Ethan's in prison, who's this guy calling him Sergey, what's going on here. So right out of the gates, we're into the thick of it. And so Ethan, of course, gets broken out. Cole, I know you enjoyed that breaking out scene because we had a little Sinatra playing over the speakers there, over the PA system.
Oh yeah, Dean Martin, fuck yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we gotta.
You know your boy loves that. I also just love a good jailbreak scene too. You know,
yeah,
like it kind of had it all. It had the beautiful long Tom Cruise hair, like somehow has the mm-hmm. cleanest, greatest hair, and but he's in fucking prison and. I'm not even sure, Ukraine or something, you know, but
yeah.
like somehow he still got a good barber. But no, I love that scene, man. It's also some of the stuff that they do in this one that I feel like is different than some of the others is that he kind of just takes ass beatings in some of these. Fallout less so, but in this one, like the amount of like running into shit and like falling down or like running through a wall but still getting something done is always just really funny. Mm-hmm. It's a good move because when he's breaking out of prison, but like the prison guards are hitting him with nightsticks, but he's still finding ways to fight them. And then there's these really giant dudes. It's just all really clever. And like, it kind of takes the superhero-ness out of it. Right. Because he is obviously a badass and we know that he's going to complete the mission and all that sort of stuff, but it also makes it a little comedic. And I feel like we've kind of lost that a little bit to some extent, even though there was some scenes in Fallout that I'm sure we'll get to that we can talk about, that, you know, still have that vibe. But that vibe, I think, is part of the reason I like this one more than some of the other ones.
Yeah, it's really good. And like you said, and I think it played well with him breaking out of prison because we don't know how long he had been in there. But to me, it played like a little bit like Casino Royale, where we have Bond out in the field for the first time, so he's making mistakes. We've got Ethan, who's probably just not as sharp as he has been, because for the most part he's either at IMF headquarters or he's out in the field, and so of course he can stay sharp. In prison, he can't really do that, and so, you know, he's a little bit rusty, or he can't quite get, you know, do the things that he was doing because he hadn't been in the field in, you know, a few months or a year or however long he had been in that prison. So, you know, Benji breaking him out, and it's funny because he's like trying to get Benji to open all the doors, and he's making all the hand signals in the cameras. That was funny to me. Benji was like, "No, I know what it means. I'm not going to do it." And he's like sitting there,
yeah.
And Ethan keeps making the hand gestures, but he gets broken.
He's waiting at the guards.
That dude is so funny.
Yeah. He's like,
And Benji's just in the truck. He's like, nope, not going to do it. I do hate that we didn't have Luther in this one, man. I was really hoping that he would pop in somewhere. But it's okay. It's all right. Like, I'm fine.
We get him for a second. Yeah, we get him at the end there.
I mean, I was hoping that he would jump in, you know, somewhere where it looked like, okay, the team is actually lost, and then Luther would show up in a helicopter or something. Yeah. He probably got his $5 million for popping in at the end there to have, you know, quick brunch or whatever they're doing there. But we get the gist of the mission. So he's broken out, and what we think is a rescue mission. He's like, he looks at the team, he looks at Jane, and he's asking, okay, you know, why did y'all break me out? Because whatever's going on out here, it's got to be really bad. So, of course, she gives him the rundown. Chris, you know, as far as getting the rundown of the mission and letting us know what's happening, is, you know, it's Russian nuclear launch codes, and, you know, Jane and her partner Hannaway were going to retrieve them, and then they got intercepted. You know, having that introduced to us in the beginning and letting us know kind of what we're going after is a good way to start off after that cool prison break. Yeah. No, absolutely. And we get some really cool gadgets in this one, and I thought it was interesting because I feel like, you know, playing up to kind of the Bond thing that we've talked about before, but Cole, you know, getting, you know, for the most part in the first few, we got the mask we're using or some other things that IMF would include, but this one it feels like it turned up a notch, especially like the prison break with whatever that particular gun was used to, like, break out the floor or the ceiling so they could jump down, and different things to get in and out of scenarios. We had the facial recognition, we had the, you know, the printing of the nuclear launch clothes with the contact lenses, going from that into the Kremlin scene. So actually the Kremlin scene where Ethan and Benji use the screen to mask the hallway, I thought that was a really cool scene.
And that fucking screen, dude.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's so cool because it's one of those scenes, and I talked about it in Rogue Nation, where Ethan was caught in that, you know, in that tunnel in the water, and I felt like I was holding my breath with him. But it's one of those scenes where I feel like the audience is also being quiet in the theater, because this scene where they have to be completely quiet so they can mirror that hallway. But, you know, we're dialing up the gadgets a little bit more in this one, Cole, and we'll kind of talk about that and playing into okay, at IMF we have all these really cool gadgets, let's use them. Another decision that's made, and I think it worked really well, how do you feel like the introducing more gadgets to help them achieve their missions, like with Brant using his, you know, the metal suit that he had or whatever to go through the ducks. How do you feel about all the gadgets?
Man, the gadgets fucking rock in this, right? And I think that they this is the best of the series at that, because there's like there's so much just really cool shit, but like the thing about all of it, I felt like was very believable.
Yeah.
Like even in some of the Bond movies, some of the stuff like having a laser in your watch just doesn't really feel like something that
like
you
what's
could
the power source
do,
of that, right?
But none of this, like a screen being used to track somebody's facial expressions, or a suit made of magnets that you catch with a, you know, remote control driven car, or the even the contact lens, right? Like it seems like all of that is something that it could realistically do. And the printer built into the briefcase is a little far, but it's still not something that you're just 100% like, yeah, there's just no way this could happen, right? And I think that the gadgets and the stuff like that kind of add an extra element to this one that I really enjoyed, because they weren't just like, I guess that guy is kind of right with this, Chris. They didn't just do all these crazy action sequences all the time. Instead, they would use like gadgets to, you know, make a scene have a little bit more, you know, intensity to it. Like when you notice that Lea Seydoux's character was noticing his eye, was something was odd about it,
right?
You start getting
absolutely
a little tense, you know what I mean? And that is one of those sequences that I think is the coolest part of this, is that they play with you in a different way rather than just having a car chase here and then a shootout here and then jumping on an airplane here. And all that stuff is great. I love all that sort of stuff too, but I did feel like, you're right, Keith, like the gadgets, the things like that just kind of were a different take on action, because that's
it
what
was,
it was.
And it just made it cooler. I don't know. I mean, we just didn't really see gadgets like this in the others, and so to have it really dialed up with all the different parts, and you know, and but it seemed just like more practical things. And I know that they weren't just practical, because it was a contact lens that could blink and send, you know, print paper to another to a remote briefcase, but it was something that we just didn't see before, so it was cool to get that incorporated into this. But also just in the grand scheme of the plot that they're going into, like we get pieces of the plot fed to us, and it's cool because us as an audience, like we're continuously trying to figure out, okay, who's playing what role in this, and also how do we get to this point? I mean, we, you know, why is Ethan in jail? And then we get the, you know, heard Benji talking about, you know, he heard about an unsanctioned hit, and then whenever we get Brant, we, you know, we see that he's a chief analyst, but he also has some skills as well. So it's like, so what's his story? You know, Chris talking about getting bits and pieces mm-hmm. of this, and like still not knowing why Ethan was in jail for, you know, almost hour and a half, 2 hours into this thing, when Brant tells his story as far as why he's in the office and not in the field now, and then Ethan trying to retrieve the codes, but also Hannaway and Moreau and how everybody fits into this. Like, I think it's not one of those cases where we're getting fed piecemeal, we're not getting short ended on as far as getting the plot, but we're getting the plot almost like as the team is getting it as well, and we're trying to piece it together too. I think that plays to make it, like Cole said, seem more mysterious and seem more intense.
It does, yeah, that certainly does add to some of the mystery of it. And I think we were talking about it last week, like you have to spice it up and add some stuff like that to these to keep them from mm-hmm. feeling so samey, to keep them feeling so, you know, monster of the weekish. I know these are movies that have them out with years in between them, but you kind of have to sprinkle in like a bit of mystery where you can to, you know, just, and granted, if these movies were just super focused on here's a mission, here's a team, go do the thing, they'd still be a great time, but they're just like elevated by allowing you to relate to the characters and allowing you to kind of like step into it and be a bit of a more active participant in the film, because you're trying to figure out what's going on, why is somebody doing this. Because, you know, the one thing that we do give these movies credit for, like, you know, everything else is relatively straightforward. You know exactly who the bad guy is. You know, for the most part, what their plan is. You know what you need to do to stop it. So it's like so much of it is just watching stuff play out. And again, it's it's a movie, right? That's going to be what the bulk of it is anyway, but it's nice to have those parts that kind of invite you in and keep you thinking enough so that these movies where you turn your brain off typically anyways, but you can just get so caught up in just being a part of the action that you are just kind of watching and enjoying it and not really thinking. So I do like when they're able to add a bit of mystery to them like they do in this one. And maybe that's another thing where we're talking about that kind of shift that this that they start to take from here on out. Maybe that is another one of the things that's kind of added to it. You get a lot more introspection and stuff to all the characters, and it's not just straight up like Ethan had this happen to him. It's just like you get these little nuggets and you try to have to figure out what's going on with the characters, you know, whether it's like internally you have to figure out, you know, what are some of the relationships between people. Even, you know, in Fallout, I hate to jump, but when Ilsa comes back, we know that they know each other, but you're still left trying to figure out, you know, what's she there for, what's her mission, I thought she got out, yada yada yada. So I really enjoy when they, you know, just find ways to bring you in a bit and let you try to figure something out on your own. Even if it is something that's not, you know, super attached to the plot, it's nice to, you know, like I said, be a part of the film in a way that kind of allows you to lean up a little bit and not just sit back and kick your feet up and just watch explosions and gunfights. Which, again, that's what they want to do. They're very good at it, so I wouldn't care.
do whatever we need, because obviously whatever decision makes it work in it. But I think with a movie like this, the audience does enjoy being brought along, just kind of like the Ocean series, where the plot kind of sometimes it happens behind closed doors, and sometimes we get some of the gag is right in front of us, and so people like to try to be able to figure stuff out. I mean, I know there's a lot of movies that we've watched, we tried, especially whenever it comes to dramas or mysteries or whatever, we want to figure out what's going on or how it happens and all that stuff. And so being able to see that and see, oh, okay, yeah, maybe Brent isn't what this is, or, oh, this is why the plot's going on, is pretty cool. I mean, even in the Kremlin, Cole, you know, like we've had the Kremlin, we get introduced to Wistrom, well, we get introduced to Hendrix there, but then we also, after the Kremlin explosion, now we have the Russian police after Ethan and his team too. So Ethan is not only running from, you know, trying to figure out what's going on with Cobalt and Hendrix and Wistrom. Yeah, and that now all of a sudden we have like this Russian police officer who is, you know, hot on Ethan's trail the whole time too. So we've got a lot of different things going on. Talk about, you know, going from the Kremlin to team the leader. Kremlin explosion.
To... team leader killed me every time. Caught him in the escalator.
Every time. He reminds me of the inspector from Man on Fire who's helping Christopher Walken and Denzel throughout the course of the movie. I know it's two different actors. That guy was also in Casino. He was in the Bond series there for a little bit before he turned. But anyway, getting to talk about, you know, the Kremlin and having Ethan thinking, okay, we're just going to go there and simply do this. And all of a sudden Hendrix is there and he knows that Ethan's team is there as well. And then having the Russian police follow Ethan. So now we've got, seems like two different people, two different sets of teams that we're running from now, as opposed to just Ethan trying to clear his name and go from being disavowed to back reinstated.
Yeah, that's exactly right, right? And they do a good job of increasing the stakes in this movie as well, and never to a point where it doesn't feel like it's manageable, mm-hmm. because, of course, if a situation like that occurred to the Kremlin, there would be an investigation into it, right? And that's what would happen. And that guy was traveling the world in order to find this disavowed agent, right? Like, that seems reasonable. But they also have all these other crews looking for him at the same time, because, again, they've been disavowed. They're not supposed to be. They're operating as basically rogue agents, like the secretary said. So it was all very clever stuff. All of it was, like, super fun because, you know, it was interesting to have a different type of character chasing after him, especially the guy that played the Russian police officer, like, or whatever you want to call him. Mm-hmm. That guy was just really good. And every scene he was in, it was just like, this guy kind of has something, and very enjoyable to watch him chase after Ethan Hunt, even though you knew he was going to win.
Right. Yeah. Well, because he was, I mean, well, I didn't know what side he was on, because that scene wherever the secretary went to get, you know, to brief Ethan and let him know that, like, hey, I'm taking you to Washington, but on my way between Washington, and here you're gonna, you know, you're gonna escape, and you're gonna go here, and you're gonna get in this train car. And as he's telling him that, you know, like there's the explosion, he gets shot, the driver gets shot, and all of a sudden it's like a Russian hit team is shooting at Brandt and Ethan. And so, you know, whenever the police chief does show up, then we're just like, well, me in particular, I'm like, okay, is this guy good or is he working for Cobalt or kind of like what's going on? Because there was no, I mean, like, if it's going to be police showing up, they're going to be asking questions, hopefully, and not just shooting everybody in the truck and being like, we got him, but not being able to ask questions. So I was having a hard time trying to figure out whose side he actually was on, because for two, one, because of the massive shootout there, but two, he just kept showing up, and I just didn't know what kind of access, like what kind of police chief is able to chase Ethan around like that. I mean, even at the hotel, you know, he catches Ethan there at the end, and it's like, okay, he's getting, to me, I thought he was getting fed some intel from Cobalt or for somebody. So again, to add to that mystery,
sure,
helps the plot move along and helps us kind of throws us off as far as like, who, you know, we know Hendricks and Wistrom are bad, but like, who are they working with? Who's helping them? So on and so forth, though. But I mean, it's great. Like, we didn't get the one. I mean, I guess Ethan scaling the tallest building in the world is like the big gag, but you know, it wasn't like the grand, you know, him jumping into that big water slide, or him doing the even though two is not my favorite, him going into that tower in two as well. It wasn't the rabbit's foot. What was the bad weapon called in the second one? I can't remember.
Like God something, wasn't it?
Yeah, something.
The God's Eye? No?
Damn.
I can't remember. Anyway.
Killer,
him damn, going after.
Yeah, because it was a disease.
Well, I know it was Chimera. I know it was like the virus.
That yeah.
Was, I guess yeah, that's was right.
It? Yep.
Okay.
That was it. Yep.
Yeah. That particular
he
thing.
He
but,
after all, dude. You just
yeah,
wrote
yeah,
it on
my bad. Yeah, I threw myself an alley-oop in the All-Star game. Quiet. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Did you know they brought Angelina back?
To be on the team with Ethan's dude, like.
Absolutely.
The rest of the team is around, but he's just going to do all this stuff anyway. You're there to feel useful, but he's just going to fucking light himself on fire. And I don't know.
Sorry, I made y'all run the fast break only to fake a pass to you and get the layup myself. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I faked a behind-the-back pass, but it was just a wraparound pass to myself.
Yeah.
You started yelling transition, and sprinting down the court, and then didn't even matter. I'm like, oh, what the fuck? That was yelling at me?
Yeah, that's my fault.
Jump from the free throw line. What am I down here for?
Yeah, I should have just stayed on defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean it keeps going, but we have Paula Patton brought in, and really her whole it seems like her whole mission this whole time is revenge. I mean, she's after Moreau, of course, who took out her partner Hannaway earlier in the movie. We've got Benji in the field. He passed his test and now he's out in the field for the first time as opposed to being the guy in the office. And then of course we have Brent involved as well. So we've got a lot of new people in. And everybody does, you know, clearly is doing a really good job. I really like the insertion. Man, I just really like Benji in this whole series. And I know that we said Luther is our favorite character as far as like sidekicks go or side guys go, man. But Benji being in the field and being inserted and being able to help out and, you know, in real time is
they used him the perfect amount in this one.
I agree. I was just about to say, do we feel like he was used a great amount in this one? So yeah, Cole, I'll let you kind of elaborate on that as far as Benji's role in this particular the scheme of it and the movie itself.
Yeah, so I think that he was used the perfect amount, and we had kind of talked about this last week when we were talking about Mission Impossible 3, where who was our favorite character or whatever between Luther and Benji, and I think that this one is kind of the perfect use of him, and I think because it was such a big hit, they keep going back to the well, which makes sense because Simon Pegg is fucking awesome. Even in Star Trek, he was very similar, but he crushed it. He's just really good at these roles, and he's enjoyable, and he's funny, but he also has he has a bit of character to him, like very, very positive. I like him a lot, but I do think that they kind of found the perfect amount to use him in this. And he wasn't competing with another comic relief character, mm-hmm. like in some of the later films when he has to be with Luther as well. That becomes a little too much. This was kind of the perfect balance, I feel like.
Yeah, he was really good, and I think that, you know, of course, having Paula Patton involved in this as well, and this being her only movie of the series is fine, but it, you know, I think that him being inserted into the field and then wanting to help out, and we, of course, we get more of him as the series goes on, but it's just like, Greg Cole, you're absolutely right. He's not having to navigate his comedic scenes with Luther, because Luther is going to be funny, but also he's going to be our muscle guy too. But also the guy in the truck who's also doing, I mean, he Luther is legitimately a Swiss Army knife when it comes to the IMF and this particular series, because he can do mm-hmm. all of it. And it's great too, because I love that he's not just pigeonholed into, you know, okay, he's the big guy, so he's going to be the muscle. Like, he does all the thing. He can fly the helicopters, but he can also, like, he can break into, you know, a server if he needs to. So he's used perfectly. But as we find out more about Brent, more about the mission and more about Brent, Chris, and we're seeing why he went from the field to the office after he, because basically, I mean, not basically, but Ethan calls him out, because Ethan pulls a gun on him on purpose after they had that, you know, they got chased down by what they thought was Wistrom, but it was Hendrix. And we had the big sandstorm, and then of course we saw Brent fighting in the hotel there, and mm-hmm. then Ethan's like, you know, what kind of analyst, like Cole, like you're saying, what kind of analyst can rip the top off of a gun and disable these guys like he did? So then we get that full story too. Chris, tell us, you know, talk about, you know, as far as Brent and why he is on the mission, why he is a chief analyst now as opposed to being in the field, and then just his particular role in this whole grand scheme.
Yeah, I think he's like a really interesting character, and I'll get into, you know, what he's doing on the team. I will say the one thing I maybe kind of hate, the scene where he takes the gun from Ethan and then like pulls the other one out of his back pocket was like in the trailer. So like that kind of has you mm-hmm. always looking and wondering who he is and what he's going to do. So like I wish that reveal would have been saved a lot more. Like I do hate that is in the trailer, because like, again, just the whole time you're looking at him, you're wondering, like, is he like actually the bad guy? Maybe that is a bit intentional, wants you on your toes with the new guy, but I feel like you're kind of doing that anyways in this series, especially with someone who, you know, tags along for as much of the ride as him. But you know, yeah, he's there because he was shadowing Ethan when he was in, where did he say, like Croatia or whatever, and you know, he left, and I'm blanking on show him on his character name. He left, and you know, shit went south, or so they thought, and he kind of left the field and became an analyst that way. And I think that's an interesting way to bring him in. Like, right, it's kind of weird, because like it's someone who's in these movies that's as close you can be as directly related to Ethan as possible in terms of people being on the team. So that is weird. In like a good, not weird, but it's like it's like a welcome change, instead of just being like, you know, another person who just works at IMF, who doesn't know Ethan, has no relation to him or any kind of thoughts about him until they end up on the same team. Like, it's someone with some kind of relationship and thoughts about Ethan, you know, beyond just, this is a guy I'm tasked up with for this mission. So it is interesting, like, you can have that additional dynamic between them. And it's weird, because like he does a good job of, you know, both Jeremy Renner and Brent, of not really showing that there's that connection or that there's that knowledge up until he ends up having to reveal it to him. So I think that it was interesting to have like a character that is kind of a part of the movie that has more personal stakes with Ethan. Obviously, like, he's still a part of the mission and wants to get that done, but that is certainly an interesting way to bring someone out. I can't think if there's, I don't know if there's another character in the movie that's just like that. Cause obviously there are some reoccurring characters, but you know, they've worked, like, you know,
they're in the field,
like Luther and even Ilse, like they've worked with, yeah, like they've worked with and they've become close to him that way. But this guy is like, and granted, it was still work, the thing that happened that kind of tied him to him. But I think that's nice. And again, these, you know, this era, if I want to say that, of the films does a good job of that, of kind of creating some more personal stakes. And the first three certainly had that as well, but this has like a lot of ones that are just like coming from a lot of different angles to just create more personal stakes for the characters, which is, you know, I think that's one of another things you have to do to keep them from feeling so samey.
Well, for sure. And Julia is her name, the Michelle Moynihan, the
Julia, God, wife. I know that, I don't know why I just blanked on it.
Well, she's like in it a lot, but then enough to where it's like, we remember her, but then forget her at the same time. But yeah, Julia is her name. Wanaka is Lake Wanaka.
Lake Wanaka.
That's what Ethan wants us to do, though. So I was just, you know, sticking to the plot. I was doing what I was supposed to do. I forgot about her. She was in the wind.
Yeah, that's right.
It happens like that sometimes, man. It happens to the best of us.
5'2" Ethan Hunt doesn't have to beat me up. You reckon the three of us could take him? If we could just, you know, kind of circle up on him.
On Ethan?
Yeah. If we kind of scare him a little bit. I think we could, if we just circle him and give him away at him, maybe corner him a little bit. I'm afraid he would just, like,
a lot of people
drop down like a cartoon character and we'd all bump our heads like the Three Stooges, though, so maybe you're right. Give us a Looney Tunes ass whooping.
Doom! Yeah, I mean, maybe if we, like, really thought it out. Traps, you know? I think we're pretty smart.
Just set up some traps!
Yeah, like the Home Alone house. Yeah. Like, I think we might be okay.
Do that hip little rope and anvil tactic that they were trying to do on the Roadrunner. Yeah. You might be right.
Instead of cans of paint.
Have a screen, make them run into it.
Nuts and taint.
See, we just have to think about it. I think we could get them. Yeah, you can put him in a box and shake him up a little bit, scare him.
Yeah.
Well, we just have a box propped up with a stick, but have the string attached to it, and under the box you just have a bunch of masks, you know? He's like, oh, they're the masks that I lost. I thought they were in IMF, but they were here.
That's where the mask. Yeah,
that's where I left all the masks. And then we just pull the string, and he gets caught in the box.
You just put. We just, like, we set up a box with a rope, and then we put one of those little machines that they use to audit themselves with Scientology, and then when he goes in it, we just pull, snatch a rope.
Bam, right there. Yep. We got it.
Box is, like, shaking around like there's a bird in there. He never lifts it up. He just, like, moving side to side. He's just moving a little bit.
Yeah, and then Keith sits on top of the box. No, Chris sits on top of the box.
He's definitely not getting out. Then we got him. This is a solid plan. Why is no one else in these movies ever thought about this?
And then we say mission accomplished after.
For sure, yeah. Right, yep. Sure. Yep. Boing, 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 boing. Yeah.
Like an accordion. He.
Yeah. Yep. He spits the keys out.
One of my favorite gags. Man, listen. Listen, man. The Looney Tunes gags were top tier, man. That stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You talk about jokes that would crush me. Those were top tier. Like, Wile E. Coyote, everything that happened to him was the funniest thing of all time.
They got to lean into. Yeah.
They should. I'm with Chris. Like, drop anvil on him flat for a second.
Yeah. That would be so funny.
We're already naming gags. But that one's like the funniest one. So he said drop an anvil on. The funniest part is I think maybe that one's so funny because like someone's probably tried some shit like that on Ethan Hunt. So it's just like, yeah, they did do that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, somebody tried that.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
Yeah, when he was in like Austria or something, somebody was like, let's try this. And it just didn't work. He had an umbrella that it bounced off the umbrella or something. It flattened one of their teammates instead.
He kind of did something similar when he did like the zip line onto the truck thing. That's some Looney Tunes shit, man.
Man, I know his like shoulder was barking for like weeks.
Oh yeah, you fall off the top of that truck, you're just dead.
You know, like all the speed that he picked up. God, they really do fuck him up in this movie. You're right.
They fuck him up
big time.
In the car garage, dude.
He gets hit by a car.
He does.
Like genuinely hit by
hit
a car.
Hit by a car. He jumps on one and breaks out the back windshield of it.
Falls. Yeah. He
falls face first into one, and then he just drives the car off of it.
That to me is one of the most
like on his feet. The gremlin.
Oh yeah.
That might be one of the most insane things he's done. Like, and he's done some crazy shit, but that, like, thing of, like, driving the car straight off of that, you know,
just drove it
the
straight down. Machine,
just drive it straight off that little ledge, yeah. Dude. He put his seatbelt on. That might be the funniest fucking part.
Yep.
It's like, yeah, sorry,
it's
buddy.
It's the right thing to do, you know? You don't
it
want to get the windshield. Yeah.
But holy shit. Was that a choice?
Yeah, homeboy just drove down. Well, I mean, he had already seen Hendrix just jump off of the platform. He just grabbed the briefcase and jumped down. And survived the fall, too. Cole, I meant to ask you this earlier, but did you like the beginning? We had the opening credits, and it basically was the trailer for the movie and the beginning of the movie.
I do. I hate those, man.
I was going to say, I don't like those either.
Because I'm like, man, don't show me every fucking scene, you know?
In the movie.
My eyes if like, I
during
seen
the movie.
In a long time. Yeah, yeah. It's wild. It's kind of ballsy, so I respect it, but I'm not a fan.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird.
It's like, let me show you all of the big action sequences. Yeah.
Before the movie actually starts. Yep. Yeah, I thought that was a weird touch, but, you know, it's okay. I mean, you got to take the good with the bad sometimes.
Yeah, they do it with the three latest ones, right? Or all of them, even. I think they do it with all of them. Yeah.
Unfortunately, it just be like that. But we'll move on to the categories, man, because I don't want to. I'm still just over thinking about, like, accordion Ethan Hunt just walking around making that noise after he gets flattened by an anvil.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
But I had, so for Laugh Out Loud, I had a couple. The opening scene, the prison escape, was just pretty funny just in general because it's supposed to be a serious escape. But the scene in the hotel when after Ethan had gone up to, he had gone up to the you know, he lost his gloves, he had to climb up there with one hand, and then he gets into the server, and then he has to come back down, he doesn't have enough rope, and then Brant and Paula Patton's character, she what was her name again? I had it written down. Jane. They both have to catch Ethan as he almost falls out of the window. So they grab him and they pull him back in the room. And then Benji, you know, is out there. He's like changing the room numbers outside of the hotel rooms. And he like runs back in. He's all out of breath. He's like, whew. He's like, I did it. It wasn't easy, but I did it. And then he's like looks in there and all three laying on the ground. He's like, what'd I miss?
But I did it. Yeah. And everybody. Yeah.
So that had me laughing. Cole, what about you?
Mine's the Luther scene. I thought that was really funny. He's like, you actually said that. You said mission accomplished. And then when he was leaving, he was reaching for his wallet or whatever. And Ethan's like, you know, I got this. He's like, I know. And then just gave him the finger. That's classic. Yeah. So that one cracked me up. I still try to do that, but I'm not near as smooth with it. So I can't.
Yeah, it's a tough pull. If anyone can do it, it's you, though. You'll get it.
Just
use your time and down.
I'll work on it.
Chris, laugh out loud.
No. It's okay. This is a funny segment. These are funny things. The idea of Looney Tunes and Ethan Hunt. That might be the only way to kill him, in all honesty, now that I'm thinking about it. That's your best bet. he doesn't abide by the rules of this world.
Beep, beep.
Yeah, the mashup we didn't know we needed.
But my laugh out loud is when Benji's teaching him about the gloves. Yeah, Wile E. Coyote versus Ethan Hunt. when Benji's giving him the gloves and he's like, it's easier to remember blue is glue, and Ethan goes, when it's red and Benji's deadpan goes, yeah, dead.
Just real quick.
That just catches me. That one's funny. And it's like you said, Cole, they like use him in that way a couple of times. That is just the perfect way to do Benji. Like, you don't have to let him play up into like super heavy gags that feel like they're in a different movie. Because like this one, I think, is probably one of the funniest ones, and just like where they kind of insert the humor. Yeah. And again, it's not a bunch of funny people trying to compete with you. It's just the one guy who is able to bring a bit of comedic relief. And that one never fails to make me laugh. Like, he just immediately, like, he's, you know, he doesn't, obviously you're expecting him to rhyme like red is dead, but he doesn't do it. He just like, don't even worry about that, blue is glue. He goes, when it's red, dead.
Like, real matter of fact, real quick.
Moves on.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, he just, yeah, he got it off and then he just continued what he was saying. He just moved on.
All right, so for Mr. Mustang, I have no idea how to say this actor's name, but the actor who played Bogdan was hilarious, and he was great and turned out to be extremely useful.
Yeah, he was.
So, and he was there in the beginning, then he was there at the end. He was useful in both regards. Ethan broke him out of prison because he knew he would need him later on in the movie, and then we got him get the circle back, and he's there again to help Ethan and help the mission move along. So that's my Mr. Mustang is Bogdan. So Cole, who'd you have?
I went with Lea Seydoux. She was just really awesome in this, awesome. And it was kind of cool to see her as, like, a villain. You know, mm-hmm. like, I haven't seen her in a lot of roles where she's just, like, especially as of late in her career, she's taken on a lot more, like, serious acting roles, which are, you know, awesome. I'm a big fan of hers. But I really liked her kind of being this sinister, like, master assassin. Like, I thought that she did that really well. Didn't show very much emotion. She kind of had, like, that similar, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman vibe. But was in the movie a lot. Well, I was going to say a lot less, but wasn't the main villain, rather, because they're probably in the movie about the same. But, yeah, I went with Lea Seydoux as Moreau.
Yeah, that's a good one. Who'd you have, Chris?
Oh, man, same person, Lea Seydoux. I just really love her. I love her in everything that I see her in. She's just always fun to, like, watch. Because, again, like, she can just do a lot of different things. Even though, you know, she does kind of play the standard reserved, almost mean. Not even mean, but, you know, she definitely does play, like, a kind of a withdrawn person from time to time. But she's awesome in this. Like, the second she pops up on the screen, she just walks the guy down and kills him. Like, she has the look of someone who could just be, like, a quick little for-hire assassin. And she crushes it in this. So, yeah, not much I can add because you did a perfect job of you know, giving her our flowers here. But yeah, I think, like, it's almost funny because it feels like that's what they tried to do with the Vanessa Kirby role in Fallout a little bit. Like, granted, she is a bit more of straddling the fence to straight up being, you know,
she's not
the bad side as Leia's character. She's not French either. She's British, unfortunately. And, like, and, you know, she's very good. And again, they use her a different way. But watching this and watching that, I do kind of think, I was like, that's kind of like that quit, like, just bring in, like, the super hot actress at the time. Hot in the sense of, like, attractiveness and, you know, kind of the run that they're on. And just, you know, these moves are good about that anyway. Just kind of inserting someone in, letting them, you know, just fill up a little spot. And I just think it's done a bit better with Leia here, though. Again, she just has that assassin.
No, yeah, she's killing it. Literally.
Yeah, she only shows up and kills a guy. Yeah, literally. Literally. The first thing you see her do is kill a guy. Walks him down like a... Oh, no. Like
they had a gunfight after that. Well, Pap, I challenge you to a duel.
And a gunfight after that. Yeah, someone went all right.
Yeah.
All right, so for the Diesel Award, I went with Hendrix. He was just a terrible person all the way around. He had stolen nuclear launch codes. He had a mask, did the mask thing. He did the mask thing where he showed up at the hotel, but we thought he was Wistrom, but it was Hendrix. And then he threw himself off of a Carvana platform 1,000 feet to the ground, but then he survived the fall, and he didn't even, his plan didn't even go through like he wanted it to.
That's dedication.
So, yeah, big time. Big time. The stream radical right there. All right, so that was my Diesel. Cole, who'd you have?
Same. I mean, for many of the same reasons, you know, he legit jumped off of a base just to try to save his plan. And it almost worked, and then he just laid there and died while he watched it.
Laid there and died.
So, yeah, that's some Diesel shit.
Big time.
Like a bitch.
All right, Chris, who's your Diesel?
Guy like me would have survived that fall.
Oh, yeah, we built different, though.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, I would have survived when Ethan opened the briefcase. I would have reached my hand and covered up the button so he couldn't hit it. That's just me, though. That's just what I would
have done. Yeah, that's not much we can do about that. Yeah,
can't expect it from everybody. But I went with the same person. You know, we covered the tracks. I think he's so hilariously, like, faced, like, the wrath of Ethan Hunt more than anyone else. Like, just, like, the relentlessness of it. Ethan Hunt drove a car 100 feet towards the ground, yep, nose first, to try to stop this guy's plan. So it's just, like, he kind of, in an almost hilarious way, had to, like, deal. Like, Ethan got cartoonish on him, right? Like, he would think that he was going to get his plan. And then Ethan, like, I'm going to drive a car straight down into the ground to stop you. So, yeah, and again, you know, plan, like, there's just so many parts of that just rely on him just doing an insane thing and it just working. And you kind of have to stink, you know, for this plan to still fall through. Like, you got to really stink it up, you know.
Stink it up big time. And then didn't even go through with it after the attempted to dead himself at the end. So that was a tough break, I reckon, for him.
I think surviving and watching Ethan stop your plan kind of funny. It's also like very much so like your plan sucks.
Oh, dude, it's hilarious.
But yeah, having to take that tumble and then live to watch your plan get blown up.
Yeah.
It's very, very funny, kind of.
Like, his plan B was to just throw himself off this platform 1,000,000 feet off the ground. That was it. That was his backup. Nothing else.
With the plan. Yeah.
And just hope Ethan didn't follow him.
That's all you got.
I know he was shook as hell when Ethan got in that car and started coming down there. Because you just have to, like, there's no way he's going to come down. Like, there's nothing he can do.
He can't
like,
make it.
My plan. Mm. Yeah, like, I'm safe. Like, a mission accomplished.
$200,000 BMW off of him. Yeah.
Nose first.
All right, so for my Rents Due, actually, Cole, you talked about it a pretty good bit earlier, but Jeremy Renner as Brant, I thought he was a good insertion into the series, and for a lot of the reasons that you talked about earlier, just having him come in, and he was a relatively unknown. Of course, he had a few movies before this, but this was something that really cemented him as a star, and we got to see, I mean, I think this what you know propelled him into, you know, kind of reprising the Bourne series, and I know Matt Damon ends up coming back, but just some of the roles that he ends up getting later on, I think this movie helped him cement himself as a legit movie star, and we got to see a different aspect of what he could do. So I thought he was great as Brant. Cole, who'd you have as for Rents Due?
I'm going to go with Tom Cruise just because this is the one that this movie, it kind of reestablished this as a major.
Absolutely. Major $700 million.
Second one made a lot of money. Yeah, the second one made a ton of money and, you know, wasn't critically received very well. Third one was critically received pretty well, made a little bit of money too, but this is the one that kind of did both things really well. And after this, it was like, yeah, they're just going to keep making these, and rightfully so. So good for Tom Cruise.
Absolutely. Chris, who'd you have?
I felt like I was going to be a genius and be the person to find, like, yeah, Tom Cruise was the Rents Due in a Mission Impossible movie. I thought I had it in the bag. I was like, no one's expecting it because we've never given to him because it's just like, mm-hmm, of course it's him. But yeah. I'm like, but in this one specifically, it's Tom Cruise. And for the reason that we've been naming the past couple of weeks, like, this is where they kind of take this turn and the franchise kind of shifts. And he just takes it in stride and he plays Ethan like this, in a way, different version of Ethan just so well. Like, not only does he just, first of all, he looks really cool. Like, this is maybe the coolest he looks, like, with his long hair.
His hair looks great.
But some of the stuff that he has to do in this one, compared to what he did the first three times he played Ethan. It's just like, that's kind of a lot to ask. Like, we need you to overhaul this character, but not be super noticeable with it. Like, you know, play him where he still feels like the same person, but let's kind of implement these changes to make him a bit more personable. And again, let's every man him up a bit. And he just does like a great job of selling Ethan as like the badass, most dangerous person on earth. Also the guy who like might unironically slip on a banana peel if you put it in front of him. And like, and I think that's kind of hard, like, because like he never leans so far one way. Like it just, it has to be hard to take Ethan and play him in a way where he just starts to feel more relatable. And they do bring in some more personal stuff here, which is crazy because he was married in some of these already. But, you know, he's able to take those parts of and implement that to the character as well. And he's just like, he's really fun to watch this. And like, this one being the funny one to me, like, he does have a couple moments where he is just kind of funny. So
yeah, and if you like also consider that because of who he is and his willingness to do these stunts, he opens up a whole new way to shoot a movie, right? Because the Burj Khalifa stuff, all of the sort of stunts that he does are cool, and they'd be cool if you had a stunt double doing them, but we get to see them without being fadeaway shots because it's actually Tom Cruise hanging off the side. You know what I mean? Like, he kind of, in a lot of ways, because he's willing to do that sort of shit, opens up an action scene to make it even more of a huge deal that it should be. So it's got to be him.
Yeah, that was actually part of my trivia, because he could get Brad Bird could get a lot more camera angles from the Burj Khalifa because it was actually Tom Cruise doing that, doing those scenes. He was 1,700 feet off the ground.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So for best,
damn, that's on me. My
best
bad.
Scene, it actually, no, you're good. You're good. We're going to get there eventually, so it worked out. But best scene, we're going to go back to the Burj Khalifa, and it was just the Wishtrum meeting in general. I thought I liked the several things going on at once. We had both meetings going on two different floors and one floor relying on the other, and a lot of different things having to go on at once. And I just thought, you know, as far as missions go and as far as like actually trying to achieve an objective, I felt like that was something that would be the case, where as opposed to just being in one controlled environment, there'd be several different things going on at once that had to kind of go, not perfectly, but go correctly for the most part. So I like that. And then just, you know, everything surround, all the events surrounding the meeting at the Burj Khalifa was great. So that was my best scene. Cole, what about you?
Man, we're on the same page today, because I'm with you on that one. I think it not only that, I think it might be my favorite scene in any of the Mission Impossible movies.
It's awesome. It's so good.
Because of what you were talking about, Keith, like, there, it is so complex.
Yeah.
That plot and scheme that they put together has got so many layers to it. They have to do so many different things. The tension keeps getting more and more ratcheted up, and up to the point where it ends in, like, two separate sequences that are both extremely well acted as well, which you just weren't expecting, or I wasn't expecting from something like that to happen in this movie, because they go to the actual meet, two very different characters doing two very different things, and yet both scenes are very, very well acted. On top of the fact that he actually climbed on top of the tallest building in the world, and they allowed him to do that, and it looked cool. The desert storm, all that sort of shit, is just like unmatchable as far as I'm concerned.
It was dope. I really, really enjoyed that scene. Just from beginning to end, talking about the hesitancy, and you have Brant talking about, you know, so many minutes to the door knock, and then them having to go up to the server. And
he's like, I'm just here to help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody had a lot going on, so it was awesome. Chris, what about you? What was your best scene?
Damn, I feel like a jackass. I took a very specific part of the scene. If I can take the whole thing, I will. I was just taking the Burj Khalifa, climb, when he climbed, because, you know, like you said, Cole, I don't know, I'm sure he probably did some other stunts, some of the previous one, but this is like the first time that he does like the insane one that people are posting about and are thinking about for like all of time. And it's one of the things that makes these so memorable.
Like the one you couldn't get a stunt.
Right. Yeah, like this is where that whole thing starts, where it's just like, there's this big, crazy action set piece in these movies and Tom Cruise is actually doing it. And like, and it's one of those things that just, maybe I will pick that one because like it starts this trend of these movies just having these iconic things that we'll just always think about. And that is, it's just really cool. You know what I mean? Like, what it's relative to the scene and the movie as a whole is, like, also, like, very interesting. And I do like the use of the gadgets there. But just knowing that, you know, Tom Cruise is actually out there scaling this building. Maybe not exactly that Ethan's doing, but he is actually out there, you know, doing that. It's just really, really cool. Like, it's hard for me to put it in any other words, but just say it's just one of the coolest things that it means so much to me because, like, it starts, again, the trend of them having these super insane scenes in them that he is, like, actually doing, and the movies are made so much better for them. Like, he's driving off of a cliff in the newest one. And, you know, I'm sure they probably would have got there, you know, one way or another. But this is just, again, I don't know what else to say other than the fact, like, this is just super iconic, and it just really, you know, again, like I've said a billion times, everyone's probably sick of it, sick of me saying it, sorry my words get all jumbled up, like, these kind of take a shift here with this one, and, like, that's another one of the things that does happen, like, you get the big, crazy stunt that Tom Cruise is, like, actually putting his life on the line to do.
Right. Just so we can see.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you imagine fucking IMAX camera out there, a big ass camera?
Jesus.
Yeah, right. Hanging off a fucking window cleaner stand.
Fucking.
They got a 70mm IMAX camera.
You would need like fucking steel to hold that thing up, dangling out that window. Like, there's not even like.
Those things are huge, man. Even the ones they like use to project.
Yeah. Those things are gigantic.
That's not even the one they shot that fucker with.
Did you, Cody, see anything on the awards front?
No, nothing. No major stuff. Some Saturn stuff, but yeah. It's a Mission Impossible movie.
Right.
It's going to get its 90%, 700
made a shitload of money. Playa.
Lots of money. Lots of money. So trivia, I've already talked about. I've actually given both of my points already. Brad Bird's directorial debut for a live-action movie. And then, you know, of course, Cruise performed at that stunt in the Burj Khalifa, 1,700 feet off the ground. Maniac. What'd you guys find trivia-wise?
To the best of my knowledge, this is the 7th Tom Cruise movie we've done, which makes him our most done movie star now.
Whoa!
Yeah.
That's what happens. We do a franchise.
Oh, that's right. I was like, what else have we done? I know we did.
That'll do it. And Collateral.
We did both Top Guns. We did Collateral.
That's right. Dude. Collateral, and then
we've done the
11 of these.
All of these. Yeah.
Congrats, Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
This is your highest honor.
This is the biggest achievement, Tom Cruise.
That'll do it.
Yeah. Fuck being at the Oscars and making $1 billion for the airplane movie.
Yeah.
Think about how many times you've been mentioned on this podcast.
A lot. Yeah.
Because you love him. He knows how to make a good movie, you know?
So we did The Last Samurai.
Yeah. I'm going to have to ask it.
Hollywood's crazy.
Then we'll have to ask a couple questions.
Hollywood is crazy. I've got an idea for a movie.
Tom Hanks.
The funny part. Like, that joke is so funny because you can just say, I got an idea for a movie. And you don't even have to say the other part. Like...
I got an idea for
a
movie.
That's the joke in and of itself.
All right, so that's Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Ghost Protocol, we can find that on Paramount. And we're back to my pick, right? It's me?
Yep. It's you.
Yeah, so we're gonna stay on Paramount, stay with the franchise. We're going to wrap it up before we get to Dead Reckoning. We're going to go to Mission Impossible Fallout. So that is also on Paramount, like I said, so we can stay here on this platform. We just want to get to them before all these movies get pulled, but I'm sure they're not because we got Dead Reckoning coming out soon. Excuse me. Part 1 coming out soon. Yep, so I'm sure or hopefully all of these will be available to stream so everybody can get caught up before Dead Reckoning Part 1 comes out. So, watch Ghost Protocol and then quickly follow that up. Well, and I know it's not in order. I know that Rogue Nation is next. But if you've already listened or watched Rogue Nation, let's go to Mission Impossible Fallout. So, for all of us here at the stream team, Keith Evans, Cole Miller, Chris Lowry, 15 minutes to door knock.
Countdown is really helping.